This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In a few minutes, we look at the challenges facing those who need health care in rural areas of North Carolina. Their options aren't good and are becoming more difficult with every passing day. First, though, Cardinal Innovations Healthcare Solutions. They service mental health, developmental disorders, and substance abuse medical needs for Medicaid enrollees throughout North Carolina, including Mecklenburg County. An audit last year uncovered what state regulators and lawmakers considered to be irregularities, including extraordinarily large compensation and severance packages for upper-level management. This ultimately led to the resignation of the CEO and the temporary takeover of the organization by the state. Regulators have now turned control back over to Cardinal with a new board and new leadership. WFAE's Alex Olgan followed this unfolding story throughout last year and spoke yesterday with Cardinal's new CEO, and she joins us for a few moments at the top of the show. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
As I mentioned, the state took over the operation of this organization on a temporary basis, Cardinal Innovations Healthcare, late last year, I think December. Has it now completely transitioned back to its own entity?
Mm-hmm. As of last Saturday, the new board had their first meeting and power was given back to the new board of directors and the interim CEO, whose name is Trey Sutton.
How many of the new board of directors are actually new? Because we know that there are some members of the board who are members of the old, original board.
Right. There are only three members of the old board that are members of the new board.
And why are they part of the new board?
Well,
given the fact that the old board has done some things that the state questioned.
Right. So all the board members were nominated by county commissioners across the state that were in Cardinal's area. And those people were nominated. George Dunlap, who's a Mecklenburg County commissioner, is on there. Marcel Smith, who's a county commissioner in Halifax, is on there. And then Brian Thompson, who was on Cardinal's board but was actually kicked off the board for not falling in line with what the rest of the board of directors was doing. There is arguments that they may not be as, quote, culpable as some of the other board members.
And remind us why the state felt it necessary to go in and take over, at least on a temporary basis.
Right. So there were, like you mentioned in the audit, big executive pay and charter flights and lavish parties and board retreats in Charleston, lots and lots of administrative spending. And they didn't make changes as fast as the state wanted them to. And they paid out $3.8 million in severance to four members of top leadership, including the CEO, and the state didn't want them to pay out that severance, and they were upset, and then they came and took over.
The other very confusing aspect of this, at least to me, and maybe to many listeners, is that the state considers Cardinal Health Innovations Healthcare to be an LME MCO. That's a local management entity managed care organization, the employees of which are in the private sector, but the organization is subject to specific public sector rules. The company disagreed with that assessment. How can that be, and has that been ironed out? Under this new arrangement, new board, new leadership, is it ironclad that this is how you're supposed to operate? This is what your compensation levels are supposed to be?
The new CEO, the new interim CEO, yesterday indicated to me that yes, he gets it. Now, the old...
But he's making more than the head of an LME MCO is supposed to make under state law.
Right. So yes, he's making a little more, about $30,000 more. Now, he told me yesterday that he does have a letter of approval from the state human resources agency that said that is okay. The mandate...
Why is it okay?
We haven't seen the letter from the state human resources department yet, so I can't answer that question. But they said it was okay. Now, just for perspective, his predecessor was making three times that amount. I mean, just in salary alone.
Right.
So, yes, it's a little more than the state mandated salary, but it's not quite as high as his predecessor.
But what you're saying now is that Trey Sutton, who is the new CEO, the interim CEO, clearly understands the ground rules.
That is what he indicated to me. Now, remember, he used to work at the state health department.
Okay.
He was a CFO of the state's Medicaid division. His old boss is the head of the Medicaid division now, mm-hmm. and is one of the guys who was leading the investigation and who is in frequent contact with him. Trey mentioned to me he'd be holding monthly meetings with the state health department. It seems to me, from all indications, that they are on the same page. He gets what he's supposed to be doing.
So Trey Sutton is the new interim CEO. You spoke with him yesterday,
yes.
Alex. And why is he only interim? He has a 12-month contract.
Right.
With a 12-month severance package.
Well, it depends, right? So it starts, the severance caps out at a year. He can't get more than that.
Right.
He will get 6 months off the bat. Every month longer he stays, he'll get an additional month, but ending at 12.
That strikes me for a quasi-state employee as a very generous package. If you were a state employee of the state health department, what would your severance package
But remember,
be?
He's not a state employee.
So why is this less expensive for the state to go to an outside source to run these things if they're paying more and they're paying more in severance and they have better benefits packages than state employees have? Why? Why is it cheaper for the state to do it this way?
So you have to remember that that's not likely where they're saving money, number one.
Okay.
The whole idea of managed care organizations, that they save money on the care aspect of the individuals. Now, there's debate about whether it actually saves money, and certain research is not conclusive on that aspect. But Cardinal operates that way.
So he's interim. Why is
yes.
he, why didn't they just choose somebody to run it?
I don't know the answer to that question. He says it's up to the board and he is interested in staying longer.
That was my next question. Does he want the job?
He indicated to me that he is interested in it.
So how many managers of the previous Cardinal Innovations healthcare iteration have stayed behind? How many managers are there from the last version of this?
Well, we know that at least three other top leaders left, but from what we understand, the rest have stayed in place.
Now, the organization has promised that it's going to undergo a change of culture, and you did talk about that yesterday with Trey Sutton, and he referred to this as a culture of fear.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the change of culture the company was referring to?
Yeah. So what he told me and what we've heard from multiple sources was that there was a culture of fear under his predecessor, Richard Topping. Now, he was only there for a month under Topping's leadership, but he articulated a little bit about what he felt was the culture of fear and how he wanted to change it.
What's become clear to me is that there is a culture of fear here. Fear of making the wrong decision, fear of retribution. And I think that that's part of the culture change that I intend to drive is things don't need to go through four levels of management. I want to make folks comfortable that they can make those calls on their own. If it's the wrong call, let's sit down and talk about it. You know, did you not have the information that you needed? Do you not have the resources? Do you not have the training? But let's have an adult conversation about what went wrong and why it went wrong, not that you're in trouble as a result of making a certain decision.
In that, he was referring to his employees, because what we had heard, we actually even got anonymous letters talking about from employees of Cardinal that they were afraid of their own leadership. Now, there's another aspect of this culture of fear, and I asked him about that, about the people that Cardinal actually serves. And speaking of the culture of fear, when families have talked to me, they've said, yeah, you know, I don't want to say anything bad about Cardinal because I am afraid that they're going to cut off my services. Or I don't want to complain because I'm afraid how they'll react.
Yeah.
I assume when you say culture change, culture of fear, that also, does that extend to the families or members?
Absolutely. And maybe even more importantly, you know, we can't get better unless we know what we're not doing well. And so, you know, hopefully my folks will absolutely attest to this, that, you know, I'm open to criticism, I'm open to feedback, and we all need to be open to criticism and feedback.
How closely is the state monitoring the activities of this organization going forward? Are they going to be looking at how they handle the so-called culture of fear and whether they're going to change other aspects of their culture that we haven't talked about?
Well, Trey told me that he's going to have monthly meetings, commit to at least monthly meetings with the state health department. Previously, they had weekly meetings. Remember, the state was there for 2 months, you know, running day-to-day operations. So they were in very close contact, and they say that they will continue.
As you were talking to the new interim CEO, Trey Sutton, yesterday, there was a court hearing going on down the street, and Tom Bullock, WFAE's Tom Bullock, was there. Former CEO, and I hope I get his name right because I always get it wrong, Richard Topping.
Very good.
Thank you. And certain members of the old board tried to do, at the end of last year, an end run around regulators to protect funds that they had excess. They had excess funds.
Well, Cardinal, and this is completely legal. What I'm about to say is completely legal. Cardinal is sitting on a war chest of about $140 or so million dollars. What the board did, what the legal fight that's going on now is not necessarily an end run. They're contesting in court whether the state had the right and the ability to take over the company. And that's exactly what happened in November, as Alex was saying. It was a state takeover of a, yes, a subdivision of the state, but something that is in essence a private organization.
But just to back up, they were trying to maintain control of those funds because they feared that the state would try to take those funds away, because it was their intent, it was their contention that the takeover by the state was not legal.
That's
correct.
Is that
part of what this case is about?
Kind of. Now, legal cases are obviously pretty multi-layered. There's all kinds of different motion hearings, and that's exactly what we were dealing with yesterday. But it was fascinating because this is part of the state has already received what's called a temporary restraining order against former members of Cardinals Board and Richard Topping to stop their access to any and all of Cardinals funds while this bigger court case continues about whether, you know, who's actually running, has the right to run Cardinal. So what happened yesterday is after a certain number of temporary restraining orders, you have to get what's called a permanent injunction. Preliminary injunction. So the preliminary injunction hearing was yesterday, and it was kind of fascinating because, like all things Cardinal, it gets complicated and twisty, and random things happen that just make you kind of shake your head. Like, you know, there was certain filing paperwork that was filed that went to the wrong court or went to the wrong judge because of the snow days that we had in December. But the core of the argument that was laid out by the lawyers for Richard Topping and the former board is this. They say, you know, the state wants this injunction on us. How about this, Judge? What if we just agree, a gentleman's agreement, as it were, that we're not going to do anything? We're not going to try to spend any Cardinal money. We're not going to do anything strange until a court finally decides who has the right to run Cardinal, if the old board was indeed kicked out legally or not. Mm-hmm. And the judge was a little flummoxed by this. He was like, oh, you know, kind of interesting, but then why don't you just want the preliminary injunction? And the reason for that is an important one, because a preliminary injunction includes things like a judge saying that one side has, you know, is likely to win in a court case. It's almost like a finding. So the judge took all of this under, you know, advisement. He should issue a ruling sometime today or tomorrow, he said, certainly by the end of the week. But the other key issue here goes down to why the state took over Cardinal in the first place. And it really boils down to the word significant. Under the contract, Cardinal could be taken over, or any of these like organizations could be taken over, if there is significant financial mismanagement. That word significant is key. The state argues that, you know, everything that Alex laid out, the salaries, the severances, the parties, that's significant mismanagement. What the former board's lawyers are arguing is, when you look at the actual, get away from the dollars spent and you look at it in a percentage argument, it's a tiny fraction of their administrative budget. So that's really what this whole thing is going to boil down to. And it's going to be fascinating to watch, because it kind of reminds me of, you know, the classic 90s, what the definition of the word is. Mm-hmm. Now we're into what is the definition of significant.
So when you add up the compensation levels of the old organization, mm-hmm, and the severance levels, mm-hmm, of the old organization, and the money spent on parties and board retreats and air travel and champagne and other things like that, how much money is it? Is it hundreds of thousands or hundreds of millions of dollars?
Oh, it's certainly more in the latter. I mean, if you take compensation, you're talking, what, $3.8 million in severance, $1.2 million in CEO excessive salary. You added – go ahead, Alex.
Well, and to be clear, we don't know all the employees' top leadership salaries, because it's not public record.
So there has, mm-hmm, there's been some questions about – and we only have 30 seconds – trying to claw back some, mm-hmm, of the severance. Is that going to happen?
We don't know. Yesterday, Trey Senton, he mentioned he doesn't even know, but they are taking that amount of money from administrative dollars and say they're going to reinvest it in the community. And what they want to do is get community feedback on how to do that.
So they have, what, $600 million in administrative money at their disposal?
No, that's total. Yep, taxpayer total. Budget, right. Taxpayer-funded budget.
Okay, well, that's obviously a developing story, and we're going to have the details on it later on this week. Alex Olgan and Tom Bullock, thank you very much for joining us and updating us on this. When we come back, we talk about the state of rural health care in the state. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Adequate health care for rural communities in North Carolina is a major issue right now. Today, 20 counties in the state have no pediatricians. 26 counties are without an OBGYN, and 32 have no psychiatrists. To make matters worse, rural hospitals have been shutting their doors or on the verge of shutting down. Since 2010, 82 rural hospitals closed across the country. Four of them were in North Carolina. And of the remaining hospitals, 40% are operating in the red. A major contributor to this is the lack of proper Medicaid coverage for the working poor. It's known as the insurance coverage gap. Rural hospitals are also often unable to offer competitive wages, resulting in a shortage of competent doctors in areas that badly need them. One proposed solution is telehealth services, where patients see doctors in an online environment. But in these same rural areas, the high-speed broadband internet required for that service simply isn't available. The state's two biggest hospital systems, Charlotte's Carolinas Healthcare System and UNC Healthcare in Chapel Hill, have proposed an arrangement in which they would combine resources, which they say would lead to better service in rural areas. But the state's largest insurance provider, Blue Cross Blue Shield, has come out against the effort, saying it would increase costs. Clearly, the challenges here are formidable. A lot's at stake. So what can be done? What is being done? To find out, we turn to Dr. Steve North, medical director and founder of the Center for Rural Health Innovation. He joins us by phone. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Mike. I appreciate being here.
You're very welcome. And also with us by phone, John Coggan, the director of advocacy at the North Carolina Rural Center. John, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And we welcome back Taylor Knopf. She's a reporter for North Carolina Health News, and she joins us from a studio someplace unknown to me. That's okay. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. John, let me start with you. How long have rural areas faced the challenges that I outlined a moment ago? Has this been a long-term problem, or have we seen this develop and snowball just in recent years?
Well, I think that the snowball effect is one that's true. Our rural areas are defined by our lower population density. So the way the Rural Center defines rural is based on a county level of counties that have fewer than 250 people per square mile or fewer. And that lower population density means that it's often more difficult to get access to services such as health care, hard to get providers, quality providers, hard to get specializations, et cetera. So it's a longstanding issue for health access in rural areas, but we're seeing, as you mentioned earlier, with some more new developments in our state health policy, have made it even tougher. The American Affordable Care Act offered two ways of helping get people more insurance. One is to offer states the option of expanding Medicaid for people up to 138% of the federal poverty level. And then they also offered these exchanges on the net federal exchange that would offer people subsidies for 138% to 400% of the poverty level. For states like North Carolina that did not choose to expand Medicaid, that left this coverage gap. In North Carolina, that's about 400,000 people who are ironically not making enough money to afford health insurance. And that's we're seeing that play out, especially in rural areas where uninsured rates are even higher.
Those 400 people fall into something called the donut hole, which I called a different name a minute ago. But that's under the Affordable Care Act, John. So prior to the establishment of the Affordable Care Act, did these people have health insurance of any kind? Did they have better access to health care?
They had access in different ways, but I think the health insurance the Affordable Care Act offered an option for them to get better access, and they no longer have that.
I guess the bottom line question that I'm asking here is if in states where, and if we had done, if we'd complied with all of the requirements of the, or the suggested requirements of the Affordable Care Act, would we have less of a problem with rural health care today? If we had expanded Medicaid and taken that on, would we have this problem?
So it doesn't just boil down to Medicaid.
Okay.
That's one issue among many. Look, we have, again, with the population density issue, it's harder to attract rural providers. So you have urban areas are able to offer more competitive salary and benefit packages that attract more doctors there. Most of our universities and systems that train doctors are based in urban areas, which makes it harder to attract doctors then out to their residency and future practice in rural areas. Specializations, also it's harder. So the Medicaid issue is one issue among many, Mike.
Okay.
But it would be one issue on a policy level that would go a long way in helping.
So let me get your point of view on that, Doctor, because it seems to me that whether or not, if you have health care available to you, and one of the challenges that we're going to talk about, obviously, is the fact that you don't have it. It's difficult to get it in certain rural areas. But if you had it available, you still have to pay for it. So if you fall into that donut hole, what has been the impact of that?
You know, I see my patients who fall into that donut hole. I see patients about 2.5 days a week in a rural health center in the mountains of North Carolina. And my patients who don't have access to health care often delay treatments or don't have access to treatments, particularly specialists. I'm able to see them and provide for their hypertension and diabetes care, but being able to get an orthopedic procedure done or see a kidney specialist can be cost prohibitive for them.
Yeah. Taylor, former Governor Pat McCrory and fellow Republicans in the legislature that decided not to expand Medicaid did so because they said at the time there was no guarantee that the state could afford the expansion once the federal government stopped funding it at their initial levels. I think it was going to sunset. Federal funding was going to sunset at some point in the future. But some say that that decision was purely political, a way not to support Obamacare. So given that most legislatures represent rural areas, represent rural areas, and that 40% of the state's population, about 4 million people, live in rural areas, did they understand what this would mean to constituents living there?
I think you're right. It was a very political thing to either expand or not expand. And when you have a Republican majority, they didn't necessarily want to support the president's, at the time's, proposal. That sunset thing, you've talked to Governor Cooper about this in the past, and he seems to have some plans that he thinks will work, that he'll be able to continue that coverage. I don't know that he's ever really fleshed those out that I've heard. Maybe he has, but I think it does come down to a political thing, and it would have done a lot to help get coverage in rural areas, but you still have to have the providers there.
That's right. Well, and we'll talk about that. I talked to Governor McCrory about this innumerable times, and he was insistent that the state's Medicaid system was screwed up and that needed to be fixed first before they could accept expansion of it through the Federal Affordable Care Act. And he also said that he also referred constantly to the sunset provision. And he thought, well, there's no way we could take a chance on that, because if we expand it and can't afford it, then we're in worse trouble than we're already in. That, in a nutshell, is what they had to say about that when it was going on. John, there is a proposed piece of legislation, however, Carolina Cares, that a group of Republican legislators introduced to close this coverage gap. Where does that stand?
Well, it was introduced during the long session last year, like you said, by four Republican legislators, and it has not yet been heard in committee. But there are a group of organizations. There's a coalition of groups called Care for Carolina that is working to educate people about what this option is. It's not an outright expansion of Medicaid. It's actually providing a new type of insurance product for folks that are falling under that health insurance gap. It would, if implemented, estimated around 200,000 to 400,000 people in the insurance gap would be able to get coverage under this. It would provide coverage for hardworking people. These are people who are farmers, are fishermen, small business owners, small church pastors, who are making ends meet, but barely. Mm-hmm. They can't afford to save money for their house, a new house, a new car, their kids' education, or health insurance, or health catastrophes. So this would provide an insurance product that would be affordable based on their income level, that they would have to either be working or searching for employment at the time. They would then be able to get this health insurance product, and then they would also have to be held accountable for preventative health measures, taking care of themselves, seeing doctors on a regular basis. And it's a proposal that I think in North Carolina is worthy of some really good attention. It's proposed by a group of Republicans. Governor Cooper has come out in support of it. And the Trump administration has now said that projects like this could be excused or could fall under a Medicaid waiver. So we have this trifecta of support from both parties, and we think that as more and more people around North Carolina hear about this, they're recognizing that it could be a solution to a problem that we're seeing is felt on the ground by many people. And this is one of those areas in which, you know, we hear a lot these days about the rural-urban divide. And we do think that this issue is particularly painful for our rural areas, but it's not just rural areas that suffer. We think that a solution like this, with the proper debate and refinement of the policy, could work for rural and urban areas alike.
Let's bring this down to a personal level, because we can talk in broad strokes about policy and about the numbers of people and numbers of hospitals closing, but it's about people. And doctor, I know that you have seen firsthand the impact of a lack of medical care on people, not just on older people, but on adolescents, because as I understand it, you came to North Carolina to teach school before you became a medical doctor, and that experience led you to becoming a doctor because of what you saw in the classroom. Talk about that.
Yeah, I came to North Carolina first in 1993 as a Teach for America Corps member. I worked out in Edgecombe County at West Edgecombe School, a third through eighth grade school. And I taught exceptional education there. I often saw my students who, because of transportation issues in particular, could not make it to see the doctor. One of my one situation arose where a kid who lived in an old sharecropper's shack without running hot and cold water had stepped on a nail in the house and couldn't get to see the doctor, because the one car the family had between a couple of generations needed to be used to take people to work. And so he had this open wound on his foot, couldn't walk between classes. How a child can concentrate in a class when they have a pressing health care like that, issue like that, or others such as poor access to dental care, they can't see the board because of a lack of access to vision care, really prevents their ability to learn. And we know that healthy kids graduate from high school at a higher rate.
Right.
And high school graduation feeds into life expectancy, and it also feeds into the economic viability of a community. So there's this close relationship, I see.
And Taylor, you recently reported that rural areas have persistently higher mortality on just about every indicator, from the prevalence of diabetes to opioid use. They're older. Populations in rural areas are older, poorer, and more isolated. Do you think that most people in the state of North Carolina know this? Do you think most lawmakers know this?
Well, to be fair, a lot of our lawmakers come from these counties
that
are very rural. So they have talked about that. The ones that are living in those counties do mention this to me, that they're aware of this. This is happening in their communities, and they know people who live near them. Yes, there is a higher mortality rate. People in the greater America right now are living about 79.3 years, whereas the people in Appalachia, for example, are only living 76.9.
That's a
pretty big difference.
And Dr. North just told us an anecdotal story about a young student of his who couldn't get health care because he couldn't get transportation to health care. But there you have written about people who have transportation, but they have to use it because they have to travel fairly far distance to see a doctor because they don't have the doctors they need in the counties in which they live. You recently wrote about a three-year-old with an undiagnosed condition who's getting help at UNC Orthopedics, but the family has to travel from wherever they live to Halifax County to see specialists in Chapel Hill. And that little boy is not alone. You say that almost half of the 70,000 inpatients at UNC Rex and UNC Medical Center last year came from outside Wake, Orange, and Durham counties. And I'm sure that similar statistics can be applied to Carolina's healthcare system here in Charlotte. Talk about the impact of having to travel so far to seek treatment.
Right. You mentioned a little boy named Ryan Sutton. He lives out in Halifax, and both of his parents, his grandmother and his mother, care for him, and they're on disability, and they have mental health issues and other health issues. And the mom said, you know, just taking him to get care this past year. They put 40,000 miles on their car, which is a lot for 1 year. Mm-hmm. People typically put about 12,000. And, you know, this is a full-time job for them to take this little boy back and forth because there are not those specialists in the rural areas because the rural area population size can't support a specialist living in that area. So they drive him to UNC multiple times a week, and it's hard on them. The mom has foregone refilling her own medication just to pay for gas money to get her son to UNC.
And John Coggan, the benefits being touted by the combination of the two biggest hospital systems in North Carolina, UNC Healthcare in Chapel Hill and Carolina's healthcare system in Charlotte, one of the things that they're saying is going to happen is that they'll be able to better serve rural areas of the state. Do you think that's true? And if it is true, how are they going to do it?
Well, you know, the details on that merger are still coming forward, and it's really not at the point where I can assess what the impact is going to be on rural communities. But I will say that the imperative of getting affordable and accessible health care is important for rural communities, and not just for the people that we've been talking about, but also for the economies of our local communities. The Rural Center is an economic development organization, and we recognize that strong health care systems are important for rural North Carolina. With each physician that comes to a community, they bring 14 jobs and over $1 million in wages and benefits. Health systems in our rural counties, the health systems are in 44 of them in the top five employers. So we've got to make sure that we do take steps to shore up the financial stability and the quality of our healthcare systems in rural areas in order to take care of people, but also to have the thriving rural economy. So we look forward to hearing more details about that plan coming forward soon.
Do you know enough about it, Doctor, in 30 seconds to say that how they might do this? Are they going to add hospitals or add clinical practices to these rural areas? Or do you know anything about how they're going to do this?
I can speculate that they're going to try to grow clinical practices, outpatient practices that use various technologies to try to provide more services in the outpatient setting and then decrease the need for inpatient hospitalization.
And one of those technologies could be telemedicine, which we'll talk about in part when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the state of rural health care. It's a challenge to get it. It's a challenge to attract the medical professionals to rural areas. Hospitals are closing in rural areas. The economic impact of bringing a doctor in is very positive. The economic impact of losing a hospital is incredibly negative. And we're going to talk about more about that in the waning moments of this show with Taylor Knopf, who is a reporter for NC Health News, who joins us from WUNC in Durham. John Coggan is director of advocacy at the Rural Center, and Dr. Steve North is medical director and founder of the Center for Rural Health Innovation. One of the problems with this so-called non-merger between these two hospital systems is the fact that now Blue Cross, Blue Shield, the state's largest health insurer, has said they are opposed to this partnership, saying it would increase patient costs by anywhere between 5% and 40%, which means it would increase their costs for insuring patients at those hospitals, because the hospitals would have the ability to leverage what they charge and what they charge the insurance company. How would that impact, Doctor, those people without insurance?
I think that one of the things that many hospital systems do and small practices do is folks without health insurance have a set rate. We need to bill everyone regardless of under contracts with Medicaid, Medicare, and private insurers. But they then provide either a generous sliding scale, some sort of charity care for those patients who fall into that gap, and then also cash pay discounts for patients. So you can And timely patient payment programs. It's a gigantic issue to get access to the specialty care needed at hospitals and can really bankrupt families. Mm. Medical expenses are the number one cause of personal bankruptcy in our country.
But would any negatives that might occur because of, like rising costs by the combination of these two hospitals be offset in some way by the fact that they would somehow make access to health care easier for people in rural areas? Would the negative and the positive balance itself out in some way?
I believe there's potential for that. And what we really need are access to specialists in rural communities. One of the great examples of a statewide collaboration that has worked is the NC STEP telepsychiatry program that is a collaboration of UNC, Carolinas, East Carolina, and multiple other health systems to provide access to psychiatrists in emergency rooms for acute situations, and decreases the use of emergency department beds for placement of those patients who need inpatient psychiatric care. If the collaboration between Carolinas and UNC can result in a similar network being developed for oncology care, for pulmonology across the state, I think it would be fabulous. But it's going to take time to develop that.
Let's back up for just a second, because people may not be familiar with what exactly telemedicine is. What is it?
That's a great question. It depends on who you ask. Telehealth can involve anything from a scale sitting in the bathroom of a patient where they weigh themselves every day, and if they have congestive heart failure and their weight increases more than a pound or two, that scale sends a message to a nursing center, and clinical decisions are made based upon those results. That's a simple form of what's called remote patient monitoring.
And it sends that message how? Is it on the cell system? Is it on the internet? How does it send it?
There are a variety of ways. It can be sent via cell phone signals. It can also be sent via the internet. Some actually use plain old telephone systems.
Okay.
But the other extreme is what Carolina's Health is doing, where they have 400 intensive care unit beds in North and South Carolina that are monitored remotely from a central location in Charlotte, and the physicians are at this centralized location caring for the patients at a distance with equipment, electronic stethoscopes, and specialized cameras. They can listen to hearts and lungs. They can look in ears, eyes, nose, and throats. And so that's sort of the other extreme, is what's called tele-ICU. And allowing patients to stay closer to home, allowing smaller hospitals to actually keep some of the revenue from that care in their local hospital, as opposed to moving all of that to the large sort of mothership hospital in Charlotte. Yeah.
So what you're describing is that people who require intensive care and specialized intensive care are lying in a hospital bed in a rural hospital that may not have the staff or the right staff to monitor and make adjustments to their health care. Instead, it's being done through electronic devices that deliver that information to Charlotte, where a whole staff, a whole team has been assembled to take care of those patients.
Well, there's definitely staff still at the rural hospital.
Right,
they're
right.
Trained critical care nurses. There's, you know, an emergency room physician if things were to go horribly wrong,
mm-hmm.
and respiratory therapists. But the intensive care physician is centrally located, and perhaps a clinical pharmacist is there as well to help with those complex medication decisions.
But is there not another form of telemedicine in which patients use their own personal computers to have conversations, face-to-face conversations with doctors in other areas?
Yeah.
And is that
sort of often called direct-to-consumer?
Is that
because you sort of bypass the traditional medical system? Although we are working more and more to incorporate those into our health systems. So right now, any of us could pick up our cell phone or go on our laptop and contact one of many for-profit health systems or vendors that for $40 or $50 would be willing to listen to my complaints about sinusitis, ask me a specific set of questions, and based on guidelines and clinical judgment, decide whether or not I should be prescribed antibiotics. And those systems are great for people who can afford them. There's some concern about overprescribing of brand name antibiotics in the for-profit entities. Mm-hmm. But there's also a concern about that is one of my concerns about care becoming more disjointed. So if we don't provide that care in the context of our primary care networks, and that record never gets back to me as a primary care physician, when you, Mike, were started on an antibiotic Wednesday night, and on Friday night by an online doctor who may be in California but licensed in our state, and I don't have that record, when you call on Friday afternoon to my office and say, you know, Steve, I've got a fairly significant rash, and I don't know what antibiotic it is, that makes it really hard for me. So how do we incorporate that into the healthcare we currently provide? I think that's really important. And Carolinas and Mission Health and other health systems across the state are working to do that.
So the three kinds of telemedicine that we've talked about here, the simple stepping on a scale which communicates to your doctor, with emergency room or ICUs being monitored by doctors and teams of nurses in other parts of the state, and this situation where you get online and you have a conversation with a physician elsewhere, all require some sort of interconnection with electronics. And, John, in some areas of the state, broadband is getting access to broadband high-speed internet, which some of these services would require, it seems to me, is a challenge. And you've called broadband the rural economic development issue of our time. So what will it take to bring these things to rural areas?
It really is the rural economic development issue of our time. Mike, in some ways, North Carolina looks pretty good. We're ninth in the nation for broadband deployment. And 93% of households have access to broadband at the FCC threshold right now. The problem is, when you look down into those numbers, you see that the access isn't as great as we think. The way the FCC counts access is if one household in a census tract has access to high-speed broadband, every household, or that entire census tract, is considered covered. So the actual access isn't as great as we think. Also, when you look at the map as is, even with that access out there, 89% of the households without access are in sparsely populated areas. So the areas that are most in need of telemedicine to deliver these services to areas that aren't getting them right now are the very areas that can't get them because they don't have access. Mm-hmm. What is really needed is reframing broadband, not as a consumer issue where we're just wondering whether or not people want to purchase broadband for their home, but thinking of it as an economic development issue that touches not just healthcare, but education, public safety, and business development for our rural areas. There are some really great models out there for how to do this. New York and Minnesota have grants programs that are targeting areas that are the most rural to help incentivize competition among internet service providers. There's a lot of interest right now in North Carolina across party lines to figure out what the state's role is in solving this issue. But what we've got to do is get some consensus on what that state role is.
Well, Taylor, you report, Taylor, that the General Assembly passed a bill earlier this year that directs the State Department of Health and Human Services to study and recommend a telemedicine policy for the state. Would that policy include some sort of recommendation on how to provide broadband access to support it?
I know that they are looking at broadband access. I actually talked to a couple lawmakers yesterday about this. They don't have a set plan in motion at the right now, but they are all talking about it actively. But you have to remember, every state has very different definitions and standards, limitations, and payment methods for telemedicine. And you can't have a provider in one state providing care to a patient in another state at the moment, especially the way North Carolina is not involved in any sort of pact with any other states to do that. So there's just a lot of policy that needs to be outlined and tweaked. Okay. And
Taylor, to build on what you're saying, the insurance reimbursement is a gigantic issue. Right now, Medicare and Medicaid in our state do not recognize the home as an eligible site of care. So if my patient, who's 85, and has difficulty getting to the office, has a urinary tract infection, in an ideal world, I could send a home health nurse there with a telehealth unit. She could connect to the rural broadband that was there. And doing your analysis, I could see that patient. I could listen to their lungs. I could learn their blood pressure. I could talk to the patient about their symptoms and provide them with an antibiotic to be picked up by a family member. That's all technically possible, and it's legal, but it's not reimbursable in the state. And that lack of reimbursement for telehealth is really one of the things limiting the growth right now.
So what you're saying is, as we are facing this in so many different areas of our lives, technology has outpaced regulation and common sense, and we have to align the two.
Right, and other states are doing this well. Every year, the American Telemedicine Association rates the states on their sort of friendliness and telehealth policies. North Carolina currently has a D. Just north of us, Virginia, has an A. They lead the nation in innovation in telehealth and expansion of care led by the University of Virginia and the Virginia Telehealth Network.
We only have a few minutes left, and I don't want to leave this conversation without talking about something else that's really important when it comes to rural health care, and that is doctors and hospitals, the availability of them. The Huffington Post says if you want to watch a rural community die, kill its hospital. And, John, your organization, the North Carolina Rural Center, has developed what you call a rural count strategy for rural economic development. And you're quick to point out that hospitals play a big role in the economic health of rural communities. How so?
Well, rural hospitals are, as I said earlier, major health major employers in our areas. I mean, for every physician that you hire as part of a health system, you're going to hire another 11 nurses, you're going to hire 5 office and admin staff, you're going to hire a whole host of food services personnel, grounds and janitorial services. These hospitals are economic hubs of our rural communities. I was talking just recently with the CFO of a hospital up in the northwest part of our state, and he was saying that when he's called into the rooms for economic development conversations, when companies are thinking about locating in that area, they were always surprised. This is a high-performing rural hospital. They were always surprised that the companies didn't spend much time praising how well the hospital was performing until he realized that companies that want to locate in an area just expected the hospital. So if they weren't able to show that there was a high-quality, high-performing hospital in this area, the company would have ended the conversation there. So when we're thinking about attracting new companies to our rural areas, when we're thinking about making sure that our workforce is healthy, these hospitals play a huge role, and they're also in and of themselves economic drivers for the
community. And what's being done, Taylor, to attract medical professionals, doctors, nurses, et cetera? Because you've reported that if a medical student completes their studies in North Carolina, there's only a 38.5% chance they'll still practice medicine here. How do you keep them down on the farm once they've seen the farm?
Right. So there's a couple things. They want to incentivize physicians to go to these areas and pull them out from those areas, recruit from those rural areas, because people often want to go back home and improve their hometown. So there's incentives. You also have to make sure, like John was saying, the economy has to be stable enough for them to move their family there. A lot of them have spouses and children they want to have in a good school system. And so there's incentives. You can also do debt repayment of their student loans. If you serve so many years in a rural area, we can reimburse those or something.
It's a major challenge, and you've written a series of really interesting articles about that particular aspect of this, and I wish we had more time to go into this. And are the three of you optimistic that we're making progress? Very quickly, 5 seconds. Steve.
Yes, I think
we'll
so.
We'll see what our state does.
All right. Dr. Steve North, Medical Director and Founder of the Center for Rural Health Innovation, John Coggan, Director of Advocacy for the Rural Center, and Taylor Knopf, Reporter for NC Health News. Thank you all.